You're listening to CKGI, Gabriola Co-op Radio.
Hello, everyone. My name is Naomi Beth Walken, and I am an essayist and the inaugural Poet Laureate of Nanaimo. This series of readings is called Bookmobile. They are my musings on books, writers, and the writer's life in the form of a mixture of essays and poetry that I call ESPO. I hope they will encourage your own writing and also suggest some books that you might like to dip into. The theme of this episode is the poetry of aging. Introductory music was entitled Silver Threads Among the Gold, sung by Louise Morrissey. A nice image. However, now I'm in my 80s, my hair is almost all silver threads and no gold ones left at all. Because I can be considered elderly, I'm often asked whether there is a particular poetry of aging, a style older poets use, or indeed, subjects that they dwell on more than young poets. My first response was definitely not. We write about the seasons, as younger poets do, of daily concerns, of worries about the state of the environment, about the state of humanity. We write of found loves and lost loves, as do other poets. And we list things also, things we hate, things we admire, things, just any old things. All poets are notorious for their list poems. But is it possible that we older poets have topics that others don't write of? I did a quick survey of the themes of the hundreds of poems that I've written in the last few years. And yes, there does seem to be a preponderance of poems on death and dying. True, younger poets write touchingly of seeing their parents die, but we are the parents, or rather grandparents, who will be doing the dying shortly, and so are more aware, more scared, more terrified, or maybe more longing for the passing, and so probably dwell on death more. Here are a few of my poems on the matter of death and dying. I'm going to start with a haiku set. I'll read each one twice because these brief poems flash by almost too quickly to grasp with one reading. I'll just pause briefly after each one. Prepared at birth, now the time has come, there's just confusion. Prepared at birth, now the time has come, there's just confusion. This world's a mess, it's time to go and yet, spring blossom. This world's a mess, it's time to go and yet, spring blossom. The last act, I thought this was the dress rehearsal. The last act, I thought this was the dress rehearsal. The hill is frosted, my heart wants to travel, but my feet say, not yet. The hill is frosted, my heart wants to travel, but my feet say, not yet. When I die and go to Buddha's seventh heaven, he'll serve me sashimi. When I die and go to Buddha's seventh heaven, he'll serve me sashimi. Eyes lost in wrinkles, my nonagenarian neighbor discusses global warming. Eyes lost in wrinkles, my nonagenarian neighbor discusses global warming. In the hot bath as the steam rises, I forget my wrinkled body. in the hot bath as the steam rises, I forget my wrinkled body. Serving at the funeral, how greedily the survivors fill their plates. Serving at the funeral, how greedily the survivors fill their plates. Reading the obituaries, I absent-mindedly stroke my liver-spotted hands. Reading the obituaries, I absent-mindedly stroke my liver-spotted hands. Hanging up the new calendar, however many years, is it ever enough? Hanging up the new calendar, however many years, is it ever enough? Now for some longer poems on death and dying. In this one, I took the haiku I'd written about funerals and I added two lines to make it into a tanka, a five-line poem at funerals. Serving at the funeral, how greedily the survivors fill their plates. A man uses a crust to wipe the last remains away. Death by email. The subject space said dying. I was taken aback at its bluntness, but opened it nevertheless. It did not seem like a call for help, merely a statement of condition. The message itself confirmed my impression, telling of palliative care and pain control, yet nothing of the journey soon to be taken, nothing of the passport and necessities for the trip. In some ways, the nonchalance of the email took my breath away and made me envious, for I have had my passport ready for some years, but still I seem to have forgotten some essential she has remembered. Pretending. I'm sitting in a hot bath when from nowhere I say to him, "One of us will die first." "Yes," he replied, "I was thinking just that as I read of the death of Darwin's daughter. I wanted to rush out into the garden and give you a kiss, but I thought you would be having a good time and didn't want to disturb you." "Yes, I was," I reply. "I was pruning away like someone possessed and feeling like it was a purification. I would have hated to think about death at that moment." "I wasn't ready," I add. "I don't want us to die." He leans over the bath to kiss my upturned face, and we both smile. We know it is inevitable and that we are just foolish children pretending for a moment that it will never happen. "He's dead, you know." "He's dead, you know," they tell me, and their bodies swell with the importance that comes with such tidings. Death pumps up life, as those remaining think for a moment, "I'm still alive," as if to say that staying is more beneficial than going, when we know nothing of the going place and, in fact, very little of the staying. How the news of death strangely fills us with a distorted smugness. Passed on. He's gone. He's passed on. Come on, why not say it? He's completely dead. What could that mean, I wonder? His body's dispersed, dust to dust, flesh to compost, that much we know. But where is he? I mean, where is he? And what was he to be not here now? And what was his he-ness that we can't find it anymore? Oh dear, I'm getting confused. Won't someone please tell me exactly what has just happened? People get so solemn at a word of death. Why don't they speak low and slowly of a fling with the boss's wife? The remains of the day. I need my energy for dying. I cannot spare it for entertaining folks coming to see me die, nor for folks trying to delay my dying with pills and lotions and various prescriptions. Nor will I have energy for folks coming to gloat that their bodies are still intact while mine decays rapidly. Nor energy to waste on folks who are going to miss me too much because they've invested too much in having me around. In fact, as my days close, I would like to be lying in my favourite bed with the light filtering in through gauze curtains, that blow gently in the breeze, reminding me of the passing seasons. The Trout Quintet would be playing in an endless loop on the CD player, and Pride and Prejudice would be running endlessly on a DVD player, and on my bedside table, the remains of the day. Then I suppose, because we've more years behind us than in front of us, we older poets wax nostalgic for times past, or times we'd wished we'd had. Regrets of our omissions and commissions, things we didn't say and things we wished we hadn't said. Nearly waterfront. I've hated, but never with a knife in my hand. Loved, but rarely dissolved skin between us. Cried, but only from the tear ducts. Despaired, but never near railway tracks or waterways. I've been to Hiroshima, but didn't enter. The story of my life, nearly waterfront. Symmetry. This is a poem about a small regret of mine. Oh, if only my eyes had been further apart and my nose a little less prominent and the length from my knees to my heels 3 inches more to match my excellent thighs, I could have snagged a baron in his castle or a count in his airy chalet or a Hollywood mogul's 26-bedroom cottage. But my body is as it is, and all the above never happened, and so I live in a small vinyl-sided cottage on a tiny island. I'm attached to a man, many years my junior, who occasionally looks like Robert Redford, and who, when he is not musing on his next sculpture, is dwelling on his 2 strawberry patches and whether the birds will get the cherries. So really, I have little to whine about, even though my eyes are too close. We older poets often will reach back as far as our childhood and the possible happy times we had then, here to Tonkawa. 2 young girls, arms scratched with brambles, seated side by side on father's crazy pavement doorstep, made for just such wild women. Is it possible to have nostalgia for a village you've never lived in at a time outside your own? Well, yes, I know it is possible to have such a nostalgia, but it's also possible that we older poets are a little more cynical than younger poets. After all, we've seen it all, and human nature doesn't seem to have changed much for the better over the years. Politicians still lie as soon as they open their mouths and cheat on their expenses almost as often. Old men still marry trophy wives. People still yearn to be the rich and famous, which is such a futile ambition. Here are a couple of my more cynical poems. I would believe in dragons if I could believe in reality, which I can't. In a Neiman Marcus catalogue, I see a $1 million engagement ring. I was brought up in Blackpool, a seaside honky-tonk kind of town on the northwest coast of England. Perfect grooming for a cynic. Here's a poem about hometown. I was raised in a honky-tonk town where life was a roller coaster ride, in which screaming laughter covered infinite terror and absolute absurdity, each resident a sideshow freak when examined minutely, and worthy to be shown next to a 5-legged sheep or a sculpture of Jacob wrestling an angel. All that on the golden mile of coarseness. It was a childhood struggling with the paradox of a seaside town with freezing waters, waters that crashed over the streetcar tracks and had us running for cover. A town pervaded with the constant smell of cockles and whelks and cod and chips wrapped in pages from the News of the World. A News of the World kind of town. itself wrapped in the vulgar and tied with perverse sexuality, where dirty postcards hung in racks next to stands of Blackpool Rock and combs with your name on them. And on its three piers, slot machines, where a metal hand could be made to pick up a glass ring. Their third-rate comics laughed at their own jokes, and dusty blondes showed what was left of their weary bodies. From such a base, how could I grow up to be anything more than trivial and cynical? Recording human follies, my writing dampened with bittersweet tears.
When I get older, losing my hair, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine, birthday greetings, bottle of wine? If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Hi, my name is Cheryl Reed, and you are listening to Gabriola Co-op Radio, my station, my island.
Never mind, will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? How about when I'm 82? Will you still need me? Will you still love me? Maybe the more relevant question, not to mention the question of sex. We older writers don't write about sex quite so much, I think, as younger writers, for at our age, sex is like a dimmer switch, still turned on, but down a little lower. My next to last book of poetry was called Sex After 70. My most recent book was merely titled And After 80. Here's a reality poem about sex after 70. Sex after 70. I sit across from my publisher, who cuddles his coffee and explodes with, "What?" "I'm writing a book on haiku," I repeat calmly. "On haiku?" his face a red. "Why can't you write something people want to read, like Fishing on the West Coast?" "Or Sex After 70," I counter. "Yes, Sex After 70. His eyes switch from exasperated to hopeful. "Now there's a promising title." We both fall silent. I imagine he's weighing up the odds of me being informed on the subject. while I do a quick survey of a possible table of contents. Sex and osteoarthritis, the joints locking in positions unheard of in the Kama Sutra. Choices, orgasm or muscle cramp, whether to allow myself the pleasure of orgasm or go into the pain of a concurrent foot cramp, whether to focus on the vagina and the blissful dissolving or the foot and get that spasm dealt with and those toes straightened out. Decisions, decisions, and before I know it, I'm thinking of nouns, those nouns of haiku, and how each noun condenses a universe and packs a wallop, and how two or three nouns together, if carefully chosen, can tumble you into the void and to universes beyond, and how the pause at the fifth or the twelfth syllable, opens so many possibilities to dwarf all orgasms or cramps come to that, and transforms dark crows on bare branches into cockatoos on plum blossom. I'm writing the book on haiku, I firmly address my publisher across the steam of his coffee. He sighs, takes a sip, and asks, "When's the first draft ready?" When it comes to being witty about old age, I've been known to descend to doggerel, so here are a few lighter takes on the pains of aging. Old age 1. What, oh, what will my old age be? Sitting knitting dishcloths by the TV? Bussing to the casino with the blue rinse crowd? Bridge with my hearing aid turned up real loud? Off to the bingo hall, marker in hand, or lying on a Florida beach getting tanned. More likely I'll be out in the yard for the cure, digging the earth and spreading manure, and tending my bean rows, 8 or perhaps 9, and dancing and singing and feeling just fine. Old age 2. It's bridge and bingo, guided tours round London, Paris, Rome and Lourdes, fleeing in the winter, seeking the sun. It's drinks in Nassau, Reno fun. And when the hips begin to bother, it's replace one and then the other. And trust your children have in mind a nursing home where they are kind. For those of us older poets with beliefs, there are always those devastatingly sunny, optimistic poems about God's love. But for those of us without beliefs, there are only poems full of questions, although awe is not totally absent. Is that all life is, then? A constant journey where even after death one hasn't arrived? So many comings and goings in this world. Is there anything but movement? I suppose I should have developed some philosophical basis for my life by this time, but on pausing to think, this is all I could come up with. The poem is called Move Forward. When the sun breaks, the morning leaves apart. I know the peas will pod, the scarlet runners flower, children will flourish, and that some creative being is working full steam ahead, all is intelligence. When the rain threatens the skylights and my limbs are reluctant to move, I suspect the broccoli will never make it, know the kiwis are the wrong sex, and that every action is doubtful, and wonder at the stupidity of whoever started it all and wish it was over. When the wind blows the septic field grasses every which way, I think that what you say is the truth, and also what she and what he says. I would also believe what I said if I knew what I was saying. At such times, I believe the creator of it all is tacking frantically this way, than that. When the fog descends like a shroud on our vinyl-sided house, and the ship's horns blow in the channel, and the captain cannot see his nose in front of him, and the robins circle over the bird bath, then I know nothing, except that even though there is no clear way, and that the Creator is dubious, yet still we must move forward blindly. I leave you with a question. We elder poets may be whiny, cynical, morbid, but when you read us, don't you also find moments of deep reflection and maybe a few thoughts that have made our writing years worthwhile? I do hope so.
It's not always gonna be this way. All things must pass. All things must pass away. Sunset doesn't last only. My love is up and must be leaving. It's not always gonna be this great. All things must pass. All things must pass. Darkness only stays at night time. In the morning it will fade away. Daylight is good at arriving at the right time. It's not always.